Tzaraim Tovim, Erev Tov in Israel. A pleasure to welcome Ilana Goldstein Sachs. Bivrit, Hashem Bivrit, Zmaot Yafeh. But the Shem will be in English. She will be in English on Megillat Rut, of course, in the lead up to holiday of Shavuot. It's a pleasure to welcome Ilana. Got her made Aliyah from New York, Riverdale, growing up in Riverdale, and living in Israel already many years, and got an MA from Bar-Ilan University, teaching in many Midrashot, and it's really a pleasure to welcome here as an inaugural debut on Torah Motion for this five-part series on Megillat Rut. Vakasha.
Hello, everybody. It's nice to be here. So greetings from Efrat. I don't always mention where I'm sitting when I teach online, but for this particular series on Megillat Rut, to mention that I'm sitting in Efrat seemed to be quite relevant. Megillat Rut has always been one of my favorite books to teach in Tanakh for many reasons, which I hope will become clear in the course of the five shiurim that we will be together. But the fact that I can teach it when I can literally look out my window and see the place where the story took place, for me, it adds an added element of specialness. So I felt I should mention that. In our class today, the first class of the five classes that we'll be spending together, today I wanted to start with an introduction. And so we're going to be concentrating on the first five psukim of the Megillah, of Megillat Rut, which are in essence the introduction to the book. First, I just want to quickly go through the psukim, and then we will move from there. So, Vayihi bimei shifat ha-shoftim, Vayihi ra'av ba'aretz, Vayelech ish mi bet lechem Yehuda, Lagur b'shtei Moav, Hu v'ishto u'shnei banav. Right, there was a famine during the days of the Shoftim, and a man went, who was from Beit Lechem, 5 minutes from where I sit, went to Moab with his wife and his two sons. V'shem ha'ish Elimelech, v'shem ishto Naomi, v'shem shnei banav Machlon v'chilion, Ephratim mi-Beit Lechem Yehuda. Right? Their names, we now find out in the second pasuk, where his name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and his two sons, Machlon and Chilion, right? Again, from the city of Beit Lechem, went to Moab, right? Vayamot Elimelech, right? Elimelech dies, the husband of Naomi, and she is left with her two sons. Vayisu lahem nashim Moaviyot, shem ha'achat Orpa, v'shem ha'shenit Rut, vayishvu sham ke'eser shanim. Right, so the Elimelech dies, but the two sons Machlon and Chilion marry Moaviyah women, Moabite women. The first one named Orpah, and the second one named Ruth, and they live there for an additional 10 years. Vayamutu gam shnehem Machlon veChilion, vatishael haisha mishnei yiladei umeisha. Right, but after 10 years, Machlon and Chilion, the sons of Naomi, also die, and she is left without her husband and without her two sons, only with her two daughters-in-law. These five psukim are the introduction to the Megillah. They are all a story of a leaving, of going from Beit Lechem to Moab. Now, the rest of the Megillah is about the return. And we're going to deal with that in the remaining four shiurim that we will have together. Today we're going to concentrate only on this departure, this going from Beit Lechem to Moab. Now, the question is, what are we supposed to make of this information? Right? It's not entirely clear. There's a lot of information stuffed into these five psukim, but it's not entirely clear what we're supposed to make of them. Hold on, it's a little technical. So, the first thing that we could possibly pick up on when trying to make a decision is that there seems to be a lot of misfortune in quick succession, right? And we see, if you look again at the text, that we twice hear about death, first of Elimelech and then of the two sons. And it seems to be that one bad thing follows another for this family. Now, while the death of Elimelech might have been a natural death, he might have already been older when he passed away, it's clear that Machlon and Chilion were still relatively young when they die. They leave behind two women of childbearing age, right? So they couldn't have been too old. So their death can already be described as something of a tragedy. And even their names, Machlon and Chilion, seem to imply something of self-destruction, right? There's something very disastrous about this family, right? Machlon sounds like machala, like disease. Chilion sounds like a word that's connected to destruction. Now, while clearly this isn't what their parents named them, right? They didn't name their sons destruction and disease. And yet the text seems to be playing with this. It seems to be too close to these negative words to not have some significance for the reader. I'm reminded of a trip that my husband made to the States years ago. And, you know, the El Al security is making the usual, they're asking the usual questions that they ask. And one of the questions they ask is, what are your children's names? And he said, my children's names are Shalom, Yair, Yon, Ora. So he said, which means, you know, peace, light, you know, very happy names. And the security woman says, wow, Tim Optimim, you're very optimistic people. So I can only imagine what the security check going to Moab was like. Your children's names, Machlon, Chilion. Oh, well, you know, you're a real barrel of laughs, this family. Now, clearly, again, they did not name them these negative names. Machlon is probably from Machon Machol, right? Meaning a dance. Chilion, also something about perfection, wholeness. And yet, there seems to be play on the destruction of this family going on with these names. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, how are we supposed to judge it? In other words, what are we supposed to do with this information of the destruction? One could start to say, well, there's something about their actions that they're being punished for. And yet there is no, and this seems to be indicated by the fact that it happens in quick succession in the text, even though in reality it happened over more than 10 years. So on the one hand, there seems to be some indication of punishment going on. On the other hand, there is no explicit judgment in the text. There's nowhere does it say that they are being punished. And so we're not entirely clear what we are supposed to be doing with this information. Okay. The Chazal, right, the sages definitely saw this text as saying negative things about the family of Elimelech. Tanu Rabbanan, Ein yotzin mi'aretz lechutz la'aretz, ela im, v'chulei v'chulei. The text in Baba Vatra, Tzadi Aleph Amud Aleph, starts by the context of this midrash about the family that we're about to read, talks about this idea that you're not supposed to, if you're living in Eretz Yisrael, you're not supposed to leave Eretz Yisrael except under very specific circumstances. I didn't bring the whole text here, but basically the idea is if you cannot afford to live, if you do not have enough money to buy the food that you need, then you are allowed to leave. Otherwise, you are not allowed to leave. And then they bring the example. V'chein haya Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai omer le'Omer, Elimelech machlon v'chilion gdolei hador hayu, ufarnesei hador hayu, umipnei man enshu, mipnei sheyatzu me'eretz, me'aretz lechutz la'aretz, right? So Elimelech and his sons were prominent members of their generation, and they were leaders of their generation. And why were they punished, right? The indication, the obvious explanation according to Chazal is that they were being punished because they left Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz La'aretz. Now, Chazal here are making an assumption, right? Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai is making the assumption that they were leaders. We don't know that explicitly from the text, but that is their assumption. Why would they be worthy of such punishment, right? Why would they deserve such punishment? Because they were leaders who left. Right, and that is something that is very bad. And clearly, they are being contrasted here with a character who we haven't met yet, the character of Boaz, who is the leader who stays. And those two, and what we see in the behavior of Boaz, that he is a leader of sorts, if not an official leader, then a someone who definitely leads and helps people out. And he is clearly being contrasted here with Elimelech and his sons. And then the Midrash goes on. Umipnei man and shu, that we read already. Shine emar, how do we know that this was true? Vatehom kol ha'ir aleihem vatomana hazot naomi. Later on in Perek Aleph, which we'll see later on in this, in our series, Naomi and Ruth come back to Beit Lechem, and all the people are whispering in the marketplace, hazot naomi, is this Naomi? Right, is this really Naomi? Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak says, Amru chazitem Naomi sheyatza me'aretz lechutz la'aretz ma'altala. Right, it was the gossip of the marketplace where, which when they're saying, do you see Naomi? Do you see what has happened to her? She left and she was all important and now she has come back with nothing. Right, in that statement of the people of Beit Lechem when she returns, which seems to imply some sort of criticism, they're building this story that look at what she was and look what she was is now. And this is all because they were leaders who left Beit Lechem. And then the Gemara continues, Va'amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Oto hayom shebat Ruta Moavia le'eretz Yisrael, Meta ishto shel Boaz. Right? Rabbi Yitzchak makes another comment, and he says, on that very day that Naomi and Ruth came to Beit Lechem was the day that Boaz's wife died, meaning that at the very moment that he loses his wife, there's already kind of like the solution to his loneliness, the solution to his lack of family already in place. And again here, I think the text is trying to compare the situation of Boaz who stayed in Beit Lechem and Elimelech. Elimelech, he dies, but Boaz, when he has a problem, the solution to his problem is already in place to help him. Such is the difference between a person like Elimelech and a person like Boaz. Now, if you look at, to our text, you can see certain hints to this idea that Chazal are presenting, that the problem with this family is that they left. That they left Beit Lechem and they went to live in Chutz La'aretz, right? And we see this by the fact that there is not only an emphasis on the fact that they're living in Moab, but there's sort of like a progression as to the degree to which they have actually left, right? So first we see in the first verse that they have gone lagur bisdei Moab, to reside in the country of Moab. In the second verse, in Pasuk Bet, we already hear, right, that the Vayavos Sedei Moav, they came to Moav and remained there, right? No longer are they there just to escape famine. They're staying there. Vayamot Elimelech Ish Naomi, and then Elimelech dies. And then in Pasuk Dalet, verse 4, Vayis'u Lahem Nashim Moaviyot, right now they're settling down with Moabite women. Right, Ruth and Orpah, Vayeshvu Sham Ke'eser Shanim. Right, 10 years is already permanence. Right, so they're not just simply leaving Moab in order not to starve. They're there longer than they need to be. And so perhaps this is a hint to this idea that Chazal are building on in the Gemara that we saw from Bava Batra. Another aspect of the text that we have read in these five psukim, which for a trained reader of Tanakh should already be setting off alarms, right? That not only did they leave, right? Not only did they leave Beit Lechem during a famine, but they specifically went to Moav, right? And this is something which, you know, again, we've seen this a number of times in the text already. It says it in verse 1, it repeats it in verse 2. And in verse 4, we see that they are marrying Moabites, not simply dwelling for a temporary amount of time in Moav. And the significance of the fact that they're going to Moav and not to some other place, right? We know a lot of stories in Tanakh where there's famines that need to be escaped and people go to all sorts of places. So even Mitzrayim, which at least post slavery in Mitzrayim is seen as a place that we shouldn't go to, but even Mitzrayim, it's understandable why the people went there. There's a lot of water. Moav, perhaps it was better than Beit Lechem, but it certainly wasn't the Gan Eden of Mitzrayim, of Egypt. And so there seems to be less of a reason to go there, and there seems to be a lot of reason not to go there. So I just want to do a quick background on what Moav means in Tanakh. So first of all, the origins of Moab, of course, are with the city of Sodom. Sodom is the infamous evil city, which we first learn in the story of Abraham and Lot. When Lot and Abraham decide that they have to separate because there's not enough space for them, Lot decides to settle in the city, near the city of Sodom. And we are told here in verse 13, from the 13th chapter of Bereshit, now the inhabitants of Sodom were very wicked, right? So the first time we meet Sodom, they're already known to be wicked. And then again, later on, during the famous story where Hashem decides that they are so wicked that they need to be destroyed, we are again reminded of their wickedness, right? Zakat Sodom va'amora ki rabba v'chata'am ki chavda me'od, right? The city of Sodom, their sins are so great and so grave, right? And this is contrasted with Avraham, who just before that is remembered by Hashem for being someone who is concerned with justice and doing what is right and righteousness, right? So when Lot leaves Avraham and goes to Sodom, he's leaving righteousness and he's going to the evil, sinful city of Sodom. And of course, the well-known end of the story of Lot in Sodom, he is saved by the merit of Avraham. Hashem agrees to save Lot. He escapes Sodom. His daughters, who think they are the last people on earth, decide that they're going to have children with their father. And two children are born from these unions, right? There's the older daughter has a son named Moav, which is a play on Me'av from father, meaning she's very clearly stating where this child is from. And the second child is Ammon, right? So the origins of Sodom are both connected to this very questionable union between Lot and his daughter, but also connected, more significantly for us, to the evil city of Sodom. Now, to be clear, Lot is not quite as bad as the people of Sodom. We'll see in a moment, briefly, he isn't as bad as the people of Sodom, but neither does he ever return to Abraham. So he's kind of like in this in-between state between not being quite evil and not being very good. And the question with Lot always is, where is he going to end up? And ultimately, we see that the nation of Moab, where Elimelech and his family have decided to settle, are known for the same evils that Sodom is remembered for. So for example, I'll start with the second source here. If Sodom ultimately is remembered for, this is a quote from Yechezkel, Hine ze haya avon Sodom achotech, right? He's talking to Am Yisrael saying, your sister, right? Comparing Bnei Yisrael to Sodom. This was their avon. Sivat lechem v'shavat hashket hayala v'livnoteh v'yadani v'yavion lo hechazika. Right? What was their sin? That the people had Sodom had plenty of bread and untroubled tranquility, yet she did not support the poor and the needy. Right? That is what the major sin that Sodom is not known for not supporting the poor and the needy. Right? The Moavim are also remembered for this same bad thing. When Bnei Israel leave Egypt, they go through, they want to go through the country of Moab and Ammon, and they do not let them go through, and they don't give them any provisions for the way to help them out. I guess the assumption would be that they were related, these nations were related, they would certainly help them out. And so ultimately, lo yavo amoni u'moavi v'kahal Hashem, right? No Ammonite or Moabite shall be admitted into the congregation of the Lord, right? Even their descendants are not allowed to. Al davar asher lo kidnu etchem b'lechem u'v'mayim b'derech b'tzeitchem in Mitzrayim, because they didn't give you food and water when you were leaving Egypt, right? Very similar to the evilness of Sodom, right? Not helping out others with the most basic things, food and water when they need help. So, if you go back to the Midrashim about, if I find them easily, I'll go back to them. But you recall the Midrashim that we saw about Elimelech and his sons, slightly out of order. If you look at these two additional sources about Elimelech and his sons, two other sources from Chazal, right? We see this idea that it wasn't just that they were leaving Eretz Yisrael, that was their sin, but that they were going to specifically Moab. So for example, in Rut Rabbah, it says, Kach Elimelech haya migdolei ha-medina u-mifarnisei ha-dor. Elimelech was one of the great leaders, right, and one of the financial supporters of his generation. This is similar to what we saw in Bava Vatra. When the years of famine came, he said, "Achshav kol Yisrael misabevin pitchi." They're all going to come knocking on my door. Ze bekupato veze bekupato. They're each going to bring with them some sort of basket to collect food in. Amad uvarach lo mipnehem. Hadahu dichti vayelech ish mibet lechem Yehuda. Right. So, based on what we know about Moab, Chazal are saying they went to Moab because they were like the Moabim. They too did not want to help out people who needed help in a time of famine. And we see a similar idea in the Midrash Zuta. They married Moabite woman. What caused the tribe of Judah to marry a Moabite woman? It's interesting that they're generalizing about the entire tribe, not just about Elimelech. They acted as Ammon and Moab. They did not meet you with food and water, right? So here, Chazal are kind of bringing from what we know about Moab and suggesting they didn't go to Moab to escape famine and to get food, right? And perhaps we might add, they wouldn't have gotten food there because the Moabim were known for not sharing, but they didn't need food. They had food. They probably took their food with them. They were going there because they felt at home there, right? That they felt a kinship with the Moabim, and that's why they ended up quite symbolically in Moab. Now, interestingly, we know that this story takes place in the days of the judges, right? The first pasuk in the book of Ruth says, "Vayhi bimei shfot ha-shoftim." It was in the days when the chieftains ruled. Chieftains, or the judges, they're usually known as, right? This is in the period between Yehoshua, Joshua, and Shmuel, and then the kings. In that period, there was the period of the judges. When there was no king, there was no one unified leader. And there's like this infamous cycle that would go on in Bnei Israel that they would sin. Hashem would send an enemy as a punishment. They would suddenly remember God. They would call it to God. God would send one of the shoftim to save them. There would be peace for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, depending on the shofet. And then people would forget, and they would start to sin again. And this would go around over and over again. But this verse, "Vayhi bimei shfot ha-shoftim," is not here merely to tell us, you know, chronologically, when did this take place in Jewish history. It's telling us something about the background of Elimelech, Machlon, and Chilion, and in fact, the entire nation at this time period. Because not only were they constantly falling back into sin, but there were some very specific types of sin that were going on at the time. There was, like I said, a lot of idol worship going on, but there was also, particularly at the end of Sefer Shoftim, there is a feeling of chaos, of lawlessness, and the pinnacle of this, the worst example of something terrible that went on during the period of the Shoftim, is the infamous story of Pilegesh Begiva. We don't have time to really go through this in detail. Those who are interested, I can send these sources to afterwards. But those who know the story of Pilegesh Begiva, which is a horrible story of a Pilegesh, a concubine, who comes with her partner to Giva, which was a city in Binyamin. And they specifically go to Binyamin because it's a city of Bnei Israel and not Yevus, which was a city of one of the Canaanite nations. And nevertheless, what happens to them there? To make a terrible and long story short, she is both raped and murdered. And the story is told in the language, and this is what you see on the sheet on the page in front of you, in the language of the story of Lot in stone. The implication, of course, being that that Am Yisrael at this time period has become like the people of stone. So what we see later on in the book of Yechezkel, where Yechezkel is warning the people not to be like stone, this actually started much, much earlier during the period of the Shoftim. when already there we see this terrible behavior. So the period of the Shoftim is a period where there's this great danger that the people are beginning to or are acting like stone. And we see that again in a different way, not with direct murder and rape, but in another way that Elimelech and his family are acting typically like stone and their close relatives, the Moabites. And that is the background that we see in the story, that we see built upon in these midrashim of Chazal, but which we see there are very strong clues to in the text itself. And then we get to another midrash, which appears in Bava Vatra on the same page that we saw that first midrash about Elimelech. And here suddenly we are caught by surprise. Okay, so this midrash says, Amar Rabba bar Rav Huna, Amar Rav, Ivtzan ze Boaz. Right, so Rabba bar Rav Huna says in the name of Rav that Ivtzan is Boaz. Boaz is Ivtzan. Now, Ivtzan, if you don't know who he is, don't worry, you probably are not alone. In the book of Shoftim, there are the more famous Shoftim. There's Gidon, there's Shimshon, Yiftach, but there are, among others, but they're also thrown in there among these more well-known, Shoftim, where we have long stories about them, hints and mentions, brief mentions of other Shoftim. And one of them is a Shofet named Ivtzan, which I brought on the page in front of you, on the top of the page, right? This is from the book of Shoftim, Perek Yud Bet, chapter 12. Vayishpot acharav et Yisrael, Ivtzan mi beit lechem. Sorry. So, and after him, this is after the Shofet, the judge named Yiftach, was a Shofet named Ivtzan from Beit Lechem. Right, so we already see where this midrash is going, at least to some degree, right? Here's another Shofet about whom we know very little. He's from Beit Lechem. So, you know, the general rule of, you know, law conservation of biblical characters, the midrash likes to pair up biblical characters and claim that they are the same. So if he's from Beit Lechem and he's from Beit Lechem, this must be Boaz. But we'll see in a moment, there's more to it than just from Beit Lechem. By the way, some Bible scholars think that this Beit Lechem is not actually the Beit Lechem that Boaz was from. There were other Beit Lechems, one up in the Galil, and it could be that he was from there. But for the Midrash's purposes, it doesn't really matter. This Ivtzan led Israel. Vayilo shloshim banim. So this man, Ivtzan, this judge, had 60 children, and he brought in 30 women to marry his 30 sons, and he sent out his 30 daughters to marry men elsewhere. Vayishpot et Yisrael sheva shanim. He was a leader for 7 years. Vayamot Ivtzan veyikaber beit lachem. And he dies and he is buried in Beit Lachem. This is all that we know about Ivtzan. The Midrash claims that Ivtzan is Boaz. My kamash malan ki idach de Rabba bar Rav Huna. Right, this fits in with something else that we know that Rabba bar Rav Huna said somewhere else. Which was that? Damar Rabba bar Rav Huna amar Rav, me'a ve'esrim mishta'ot asa Boaz levanav. Right, Boaz, meaning Ivtzan, who has these 60 children, made 120 parties for his children, meaning for their weddings that he made by, you know, this shuffling around of his sons and his daughters. Right? And they say, we see that he has 60 children and he made 120 parties for them. And Shnei Mishtaot. For each and every one of his 60 children, he made two parties. Echad bevet aviv, ve'echad bevet chamiv, where he made one party on his home turf, and one party in honor of the wedding on the turf of the in-laws, right? So two parties for each child, 60 children, 120 parties. So clearly this is a man who not only has a lot of children, but has a lot of wealth, and he spends it, right? And he makes a lot of parties. Uvechulan lo zimen et manoach. And not to one single party of these 120 parties did he invite Manoach. Manoach, right? Who is Manoach? Manoach is the father of Shimshon, right? The next major judge who's coming up after Ivtzan, after a couple of other small ones. Manoach, he didn't invite. Well, Mapiton Manoach. What is Manoach suddenly doing here? Right? Uvechulan lo zimen et Manoach. Amar kudana akara. Right? He is a sterile mule, right? Manoach is a sterile mule, meaning at this, we know this, the beginning of the story of Shimshon, that Manoach and his wife did not have children, right? That they didn't, they were apparently, or so it seemed, sterile, right? B'mai parali, right? How will he pay me back? Right? How, if I invite him to a party, he doesn't have any children. He's not going to make any weddings. He's not going to invite me back. So I'm not going to invite him to the parties that I am making. And this is the portrayal that this midrash has of Boaz, right? Assuming again that Boaz and Ivtzan are the same person. Now, back to Elimelech for a moment. Even though the text does not judge Elimelech explicitly, There are little things in the text which allow us to understand what Chazal are getting their ideas from, that they are punished for leaving Eretz Yisrael, that they are punished for not sharing their wealth, for not giving food to those who need it. There are things in the text which allow us to understand where they're getting these ideas. But Boaz might actually be the kindest, nicest individual that we see in the entire Tanakh. Possibly. Where on earth do they get this idea that...
Could you just tell me, what's the date on that Thursday, that sign?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question.
No. Thursday, April 15th.
We must. Oh, it's this.
People should be muted. I'm muting people. I'm on top of it if there's an issue. So just go on. Sometimes people unmute by accident. Sorry about that.
No problem. So let's go back a moment and try to understand what this midrash is saying, right? They're saying that here you have Boaz, right, who they're conflating, of course, with this character of Yiftan, who is clearly wealthy, right, who is clearly has a lot of money to share with others, but he refuses to share it with Manoach, this poor individual who is not able to have children and therefore would never have an opportunity to repay him, to invite him back to a party. Now, this, of course, is exactly the type of qualities that we've seen in Sdom, in Moav, and attributed as well with some understanding to Elimelech and his family. But to Boaz, right, we haven't yet learned the rest of the Megillah, but Boaz is the exact opposite. He's the one who gives. He's the one who helps root out. He's the one who is the opposite has the opposite qualities of what we see in these other nations or in these other personalities at the beginning of the Megillah. So what on earth could the... what on earth could this midrash be saying? Why would they take the character of Boaz and literally turn it on its head and say things about Boaz of all people that seem completely out of place? It seems to me that, and I wanted to add one more thing, which I didn't, did I have it? Hold on. No, I seem not to have it. Okay. There's one more part of this midrash, which I don't have. I wasn't sure if I had added it on in the end. The very end, right after the midrash that we just read, it says one more thing. It brings another idea. Again, I think mentioned by the Rav Yitzchak, who we saw at the beginning in the midrash about about Elimelech, where it says that, and if you recall, Rav Yitzchak says in the beginning, just before this midrash, he says about Elimelech, he says about Boaz, that the day that Ruth and Naomi come to Beit Lechem, Boaz's wife died. And so when we first looked at it, we saw this as a contrast to Elimelech, right? That Elimelech, who seems to be in danger of his family dying out, right? For Boaz, the situation is solved even before he realizes that there's a problem. Right after this surprising midrash that we just saw here, there's another idea brought by Rav Yitzchak, and he says, possibly in continuation of that idea that we saw before, that all of the 60 children of Boaz died before Naomi and Ruth come to Beit Lechem, right? So suddenly what before seemed possibly as some sort of a reward for a good man, suddenly we see that Boaz is in all ways in a very similar situation to Elimelech, his not so good cousin, right? If Elimelech possibly deserved what was happening to him, right? Why does Boaz deserve to be in the same situation, right? Why is Boaz also in this, according to this midrash, in this position where all of his children have died? Now, if we're seeing it in light of this midrash that we just read, it seems very clearly to be that he is being punished for these actions, for this Sdom and Moavi-like actions of not inviting Manoach, meaning not sharing what he has with others. But the same question that we ask about that midrash, we can ask about this idea that all his children die. Why is it that Boaz is suddenly being paralleled with Elimelech instead of contrasted with him? It would seem to me that what the midrash is trying to do here is to set up Boaz not as representing Boaz himself, right? These bad qualities that we see don't seem to jive at all with what we see with Boaz, the person later on in the Megillah. But instead, it seems that possibly what the midrash is doing is setting him up as the leader of his generation in Eretz Yisrael. And there's this idea that appears elsewhere in Chazal, right? That every leader is somehow appropriate for the generation or fits with the generation that they are leading. And Dafka says this in connection with the Shoftim, right? Shmuel b'doro ki Yiftach b'doro, right? That Yiftach, who was not perfect in all ways, but neither was his generation. And somehow he was there for a particular purpose, but he was not at the level of other leaders who came before him. And this seems to be an idea that you see in various places in Chazal, and that maybe that's what we see here with Boaz, right? That Boaz here does not represent Boaz the person, but represents Boaz as the leader of his people during the time of the Shoftim. And if that's the case, then I think that the insertion of this midrash here in the context of this other negative midrash about Elimelech is a way of hinting to the reader of the midrash what the real significance of the book of Megillat Rut is, which is Elimelech and Machlon and Chilion clearly did things that were wrong. But the truth is that they die out of the story, right? They do not continue. And so the story ultimately isn't about them. The story is ultimately about the one who stayed, about Boaz. And he's the one that we have to follow. He's the one that we have to see how he dealt with the situation. And as we know from the book of Shoftim, he lived in a very bad time period for Am Yisrael. And so if we might be mistaken, we might mistakenly think that the bad guys all left, right? That the people who were like Elimelech were all the ones who left the good guys behind. This midrash is indicating that there was also this problem in Beit Lechem itself, in Eretz Yisrael at that time. And it would be a mistake to think that all is beautiful back in Beit Lechem and only the bad ones went off to Moab. And so the outcome of the story rests on Boaz, right? Because he is the leader, and the leader is the one who has to make the right decisions of how to lead the people, how to fix what is wrong. And so even though Boaz himself, we see, makes the right decisions, he does the right thing, at the beginning of the story, right, we don't know what's going to happen. And as we'll see, right, if you do nothing as a leader, right, then it's almost as bad as doing something wrong, right? And so he's presented as this character who has the great potential to do the wrong thing. And in that way, he is almost parallel to Elimelech. And only because he ends up doing what is ultimately correct does he turn into somebody who is altogether different. So it's more about the potential or the role of what he needs to do as a leader than it is about who he actually was as a person, which we know was actually quite good. And so that is the introduction to Megillat Rut, right? Where we see a very problematic time period and real difficulties that the nation has to deal with during a very difficult time period. The rest of the Megillah, from Pasuk Vav onward, from verse 6 till the end of the Megillah, is about how this problem is fixed. How do they return from Moab in every sense, not just physically getting back to Beit Lechem, but returning in every way that the people of the story, as well as the nation as a whole, have to return. But that we will discuss more in the upcoming weeks. In the time that remains, I'm happy to answer any questions that people might have, address any questions that you might have, basically.
If you can take a look in the chat box, unless you want me to feed you the questions. Otherwise, you can there are a few questions in the chat box for you.
Okay, one second, just finding it.
We'll start with David Eisen, I think, the first question on the names, the contrast of the Machlon Mechilio names to Ephrat Nomi and Beit Lechem. So, comment more than a question, but an important comment.
Okay, wait, let me find it. I see the chats now. I'm just looking for the question. Pitted against the negative imagery conveyed by the names of Elimelech's children and their friends to death, I think that they are all the more accentuated by excessively positive names in Ephrat, Naomi, Beit Lechem. Yes, it's interesting, right? Naomi, I think you're correct. I think it's a very good point. I think that we'll talk certainly about the name Beit Lechem in the future, but some of the others as well. Naomi is possibly the most interesting because one could claim that, she left just like her husband and her sons did. But in the end, she turns out to be very different. So the question is a good question to ask. I'm not sure I actually have an answer. Did she leave just because her family was leaving and she really had no choice? Was she of one mind with them when she left? Is her return, what is the reason basically for her return? Because she sees that that's what she needs to do, or is it some other reason? But it's definitely correct that Naomi and those other words, Ephrat, Beit Lechem, also the name Ruth, we'll discuss that at some later point, all have much more positive meanings. It's interesting that in the Midrash, they bend over backwards to interpret Elimelech negatively. Right? Elimelech potentially could be a very positive name, declaring God as king. But the Midrash, at least in some places, I don't remember all the different options that they throw out, but one says, right, Eli Melech, right, that the malchut, the kingship belongs to me, meaning that he was very boastful and he saw himself as deserving of the leadership. Of course, according to the Midrash's understanding of the story, that being very ironic. So his name could, in theory, could have been positive, but the Midrash tries very hard to work it otherwise. But these other words, for sure, have much more positive meaning. Correct. Let's see what else we have here. Why isn't the death of Boaz's wife viewed as negative like the death of Naomi's family? Right, so I think that ultimately when we read the rest of the Midrash, reading, I threw that in there to throw us off a little bit. Initially, we see that as a contrast to Elimelech, right? In the sense that his wife dies as well, but he's immediately offered a continuity, which is not so clear in the case of Elimelech, although obviously the continuity is the same person, but In other words, it's presented as being something that he is given immediately. But ultimately, I think you're correct. I think that in the Midrash, ultimately, they have this very weird interpretation of the character of Boaz, so that they end up, the Midrash actually ends up making the situation of Boaz and Elimelech identical, right? Both of them are have no more continuity. Both of them, their families have died. Why the Midrash does that, we've already addressed in the Shiur, but I think that's correct. But in other words, that I think Boaz there is representing a nation that in potential has no future. And only because of how the story has a positive outcome does that get turned around and the nation once again has a future. Why isn't the previous good deeds being a leader and a financial back of the generation counted to mitigate the sin of leaving? Can't a person be overwhelmed when the situation worsens and no longer feels up to the new challenges? For sure. I mean, we're all human. People definitely can feel overwhelmed. I think that the Tanakh, as well as certainly Chazal, judge very harshly leaders who back out, particularly when, again, this is how Chazal builds the story from these hints. It's particularly when you are a leader who, in theory, does have the potential to help, right? If you're wealthy and you choose to take your wealth with you instead of sharing it with others, that's seen as something negative. In other words, the picture that they're painting isn't of someone who, it's certainly someone who made a mistake, but it's someone who made a mistake, which they see as one which is very severe, because they had the potential to do what they had to do, and in the end they didn't. If I could bring a similar idea from a very different Megillah, in Megillat Esther, Mordechai says something very fascinating to Esther. Right, we kind of, when we learn the story of Megillat Esther when we're in kindergarten or whatever it is, we assume Mordechai is telling Esther, you have to save the Jewish people because you're in the palace and you're in a position to do so. But that's not what he says to her. He says, Revach v'hatzala yamod la Yehudim imakom acher. Right, the Jewish people will be saved from some other place if you don't do it. Who knows if this is the reason you became queen? His message to Esther isn't you have to do it because you're able, isn't because you're the only one who can. You have to do it because you're able to do it. Someone else will step up to the plate and fill your role. But your failure would be not doing something that you are able to do. Right? That is the idea of a leader. And so, yeah, I mean, we're all human and humans make mistakes, but leaders who don't lead are seen very, very negatively, both in the Tanakh as well as in Chazal. Maybe that is why, I'm just reading the questions, maybe that is why the captain is supposed to go down with a sinking ship, right? The responsibility of leadership remains with good times and bad, right? Making the same point, exactly. And he doesn't do what is correct until prompted, forced into it by Ruth. That's a question that we're going to deal with in other shiurim. It's a good one, but I'm not going to answer it now because it's we'll see it more specifically in the verses and the chapters of that are upcoming in the rest of the series. But definitely a good question. Question in Hebrew. Shalom Ilana, toda l'shiur nedel me'od v'kabel et ha'mekolot. Yes, I will send sources for anybody who wants to read them. Jay, you'll let me know what the best way to do that is.
Email me. Email me. We'll get it on the site.
Okay, great.
But the head of the shiur.
Oh, ahead of the shiur. Yeah, I will try to get them ahead of the shiurim from now on. I will try to do that. Boaz is slow start and hesitant to help Naomi from the get-go is explained by this midrash. He stayed in Eretz Yisrael, but he's only slightly better than Elimelech. His tight-fistedness is eventually overcome by Ruth, but without her, the midrash sees him as just as Sodomi as his kinsman Elimelech. That's possible. It could be. That's another way that you could read the midrash, that somehow he is encouraged into goodness through the actions of Ruth. That is one possible interpretation. Maybe we could bring that up again when we discuss his actual actions, when we see those psukim later on in the series. The death of Boaz's wife and his kid mean he's ready to take on roots, especially in contrast to Ploni Almoni. Possibly. Again, Ploni Almoni we'll discuss later on also. But again, definitely good point that there's comparison or contrasting going on with the character of Ploni Almoni, who we'll see later on. Can you say the women pushed the positive outcome by their faith? Definitely possible. It's something that happens a lot in Tanakh. Women are less active in some ways than men in Tanakh, but their role often is to push the men back into the place where they need to be. So that's definitely possible. Again, we'll talk about it more when we get to those psukim. This book is the introduction background to David. Why did Saul lose the kingship? When he messed up, he made excuses, but when David messed up big time, he immediately admitted it when he was confronted. Right, correct. Right. Again, the character, well, we'll talk more in the future about this book as leading into the kingship and to David HaMelech. Yes, but these are all good points. So it could be that there is a parallel here between the actions of, if you want to see Boaz as someone not necessarily doing the right thing and then admitting that he's done something wrong and correcting himself, then for sure, there is a parallel to David, who, as you pointed out, made mistakes that possibly are worse than what Shaul did, but certainly he overcomes that in a way that Shaul did not. The deaths of the children remind me of Eov. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I'm not exactly sure what to make with that good point, but it's a good one, right? There's definitely a similarity, right? The idea of losing everything, I have to think about that more. King David not only comes from Moab, but from a leader, Boaz. He has leadership from within his ancestors, so makes Eli a leader. So making Eli a leader shows lost opportunity. I'm not sure I understand the question. If someone wants to clarify the question, I might be able to address it better. I'm not sure I understand. If somebody out there wants to explain, I'm happy to address that more. Am I at the bottom? I'm at the bottom. Okay.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. I enjoyed this teaching the shiur, and I look forward to meeting with you next week.
Thank you very much. Okay, we're preaching next week. I know today it's this, and it's Yom HaZikaron. We had on our last class, actually, we heard the siren during the class. So that was actually quite moving and I think appropriate. And then, of course, we move into Yom HaTzma'ut. Tomorrow night, Moshe Sokolov, our next shiur is actually tomorrow night, Dr. Sokolov. I asked him to do the Haftorah for Yom HaTzma'ut. I have to confirm whether he's going to do for Antezriya Mitzorah or for Yom HaTzma'ut Haftorah. And then, of course, Thursday, as I mentioned earlier, where we have a shiur be'ivrit, Rabbi Vilk, on Kiddushat Ha'aretz Likrat Shnat HaShemitah. And that will be at 2 p.m. Eastern time, 9 p.m. in Israel. And then 8:30, the Parshat HaShavua shiur, Eitan Aviner, Rabbi Eitan Aviner. And of course, I'll be giving the Pirkei Avot shiur at 9:30 on Friday morning. So we look forward to seeing you. Everybody should be well. And I guess this is the week to be especially appreciative and of Medinat Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's blessing. And Rud, I think, also ties into that. The importance of Eretz Yisrael, and of course today being a very in Israel already the saddest day of the year, perhaps I would say, because it hits home the closest and the nearest time historically, and we should have peace. We should be blessed with the blessings of peace, and then to celebrate Yom HaTzmut without the Yom HaZikaron certainly before it. Okay, but thank you, Ilana. We look forward to seeing you next week. And everybody be well. And we look forward to learning with you and seeing everybody in the near future. Okay, thanks a lot. Have a wonderful day, everybody. Bye-bye.